This episode of Bitch Propaganda was recorded on Friday, July 31st at the Bitch headquarters in Portland, Oregon. Just a warning, the following podcast contains language and content that might not be suitable for the youngest of listeners, including the word bitch, of course. Also, please excuse any background noise. We promise we're saving up for our own recording studio someday, but we've still got a ways to go on that. Enjoy the podcast. All right, welcome to another episode of Bitch Propaganda. It's like The View, but with fewer bikini waxes. I'm Kelsey Wallace, the web editor at Bitch, and with me is...
I'm Annalisa Franek, formerly the operations and development assistant here at Bitch.
I'm Gabriella Salvidea, and I am the editorial intern.
And today we're going to talk about a variety of feminism and movie topics. We're going to start with a Variety article about whether or not girls can outgross guys at the box office, and an Esquire article asking, is Harry Potter emasculating America? And then we're going to talk about women and horror movies. So let's get started with the Variety article. This is an article by Nicole Laporte that came out last week, and the title is, Can Girls Outgross Guys at Box Office? Femmes Find Success with Raunchy Comedies. And I'm just going to read a quick quote, and then we'll get started talking about it. But now the ladies are shaking their own booty around, and nobody's flinching. A number of edgy, raw comedies, all written by women, have been hitting theaters and doing well, making the case that, as Smith puts it, as women, we can bring it the way guys bring it. The naughty girl movement has become so prominent that some of its members even have a tribe name. The Fempire consists of Diablo Cody, Dana Fox, Liz Merriweather, and Lorraine Scafaria. So... basically, the premise of the article is that these, you know, there is kind of a recent outpouring of quote-unquote raunchy movies that women have been involved in making. So, Gabriella, did you have any thoughts about the article or about women and raunchy comedies?
Well, what stands out to me is that, and I consider myself pretty up-to-date on, you know, pop culture stuff, but I didn't really recognize as many of the names or even the movie titles, and so I feel like a big part of what might be going on is that they're just not being marketed the same way or promoted as much, or there isn't as much money in them. I don't know, the end quote, I can't remember who it was, but he said something like, funny's funny, so, you know, it's kind of an equal playing field. But I feel like those movies just can't possibly be promoted the same way.
Like the women-made movies?
Yeah, I feel like I would know about them.
Annalie?
I mean, I guess what I was thinking most when reading it is that I thought that the topic was interesting, but when looking over what movies were listed, none of them really seemed like all that raunchy. Having seen like Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist and Juno, I feel like while those were woman-made and while there were definitely jokes in them, some of which that were related to sex, none of them really matched up in terms of how much they are focused on sex, you know, matching up to, like, Judd Apatow movies. And so I thought it was a little off target to list those as, like, these are examples of raunchy movies, The Ugly Truth, which, I mean, I haven't seen, but that also has additional issues with being called, like, a feminist movie on its own.
Right. I think that was kind of the biggest problem, besides just the fact that I thought this article was totally obnoxious, and that the quote-unquote Vampire just seems like a weird kind of Hollywood construction to try to be like, oh my god, women make movies, mm-hmm. and sometimes they talk about sex and farts, you know, it's just like, I also thought a lot of the movies that are kind of getting called up as examples, The Ugly Truth being mm-hmm. one that really stood out to me, is just not at all feminist, from what I can gather. I actually haven't seen the movie, but I have read several articles about how unfeminist it was.
Yeah.
And also just total kind of constructed for the male gaze type raunch, if that's what you want to call it. I mean, the movies that they're talking about, you know, they quote the House Bunny, or they cite the House Bunny a lot, and I actually did see that. And, you know, so much of the kind of the joking that is maybe, you know, pushing the envelope in terms of, like, sex taboos is really hot women who are kind of trying, you know, you're trying to get laughs from men by, like, yeah. you know, burping or something.
It's the Jenny McCarthy factor. I mean, it's all just trying to, like, replicate that, like, kind of hot girl. Like, a hot girl who I can drink a beer with and talk about poop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it sort of seems like they're calling it raunch and trying to create this parallel with the Judd Apatow movies, but it's really just a genre of movies where women have personalities and they aren't completely one-dimensional and crappy like in all of the Judd Apatow movies. And so, I mean, it just seems sort of strange to use the word raunchy. It seems kind of misleading.
I agree. And I also just think, you know, they're like, can women outgross men at the box office? And I still just think what the article completely missed the point of is that the movies are still being made for men, even if they're being made by women. I mean, you know, with the exception of possibly Juno, which I do think was a little bit more female-friendly just because it was telling the story of a woman, even though there was a lot that was problematic about that movie that we don't need to get into. I think that, you know, so many of these movies, I mean, what do they say, like, House Bunny, What Happens in Vegas, Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, I still feel like they're being marketed to guys and that the brand of humor is this kind of, like, male gaze, like, male raunchiness, and so that's what makes it acceptable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the whole tone of the article, too, is sort of positing it like this male-female competition, like the same old, I don't know, neck-to-neck, like, gender war thing that is just irritating.
When it's like, this is still all, to me, like, about dudes still.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I feel like it's, at the same time that it's setting up this, like, competitiveness, I feel like it's also still somewhat, like, self-congratulating of, like, oh, it's okay, guys. Like, women are making raunchy comedies. We don't have to, like, make room for female filmmakers because, look, here's examples of, you know, a handful of movies where they've already achieved this. Aren't we diverse and accepting? Like, it just, it's problematic for a lot of different reasons.
Yeah, and something that did, you know, kind of strike a chord and make me feel a little bit sad is that, you know, they're basically quoting all these filmmakers who are like, oh, the gender barrier is down when it comes to raunchy comedies. There's all this room for women. And then they say, but still, you know, studio executives almost unanimously admit, off the record, of course, that, you know, there's different boundaries when it comes to men and women. For example, the movie Spring Breakdown, which I thought was hilarious and was reviewed in the upcoming issue of Bitch, so look for that, was written by Rachel Dratch and Ryan Shiraki, who I guess is her writing partner. But it stars Amy Poehler, Rachel Dratch, and Parker Posey. And it's kind of like an old school type plot, but with women, and they go to spring break in South Padre, Texas. And I thought it was hilarious. And anyway, it was released directly to home video. It never came out in the theaters. And they're saying that, like, a potential reason for that is because it's a movie written by women about women. I don't know, it's kind of posited in the article, and I would have to agree that, like, maybe they think audiences aren't ready for it or don't want to see women in that role, and that's what sucks to me.
Yeah. Or that it's not, like, it doesn't have the typical plot lines for, like, what's thought of as a female movie. Like, to compare it to something like Baby Mama, where that does have, like, a romance plot line and all these other, like, relationship-driven
and a woman
aspects.
Kind of, yeah.
Is, I think that kind of story is seen as more marketable, even though it involves some of the same, like, it involves Amy Poehler and Tina Fey, who's also, like, fantastic and friends with Rachel Dratch. But the difference being that it fits in more with pre-existing ideas of, like, what a women's movie can be.
This spring, the wild are getting wild.
Let's take back the beach.
Posey.
I haven't been touched by a man since Clinton was in office.
Rachel Dratch.
What a walk of shame.
Damn right it's a walk of shame, because I just got me some...
Spring Breakdown, coming soon to Blu-ray and DVD.
All right, well, on that note, let's talk about some other topics relating to masculinity in movies. There was an S.T. Van Airsdale article on Esquire's blog called Is Harry Potter Emasculating America? And basically, the author is positing that, you know, prior to maybe the 2000s, teen movies involved a lot of sex, and the male protagonists, which it does seem like they're still always male, are just, like, constantly getting laid and are kind of more relatable or kind of more heroes because they're getting sex all the time. And I'll read a quick quote. At the movies in particular, it's the chaste leading the chaste. And that's two different uses of the word chaste. A curious breed of young men whose heroic priorities must supersede their biological urges, if only to protect their objects of desire. Survival, both on screen and at the box office, depends on it. Their altruism is all the more hot and bothersome to the ladies, thus reinforcing their characters' sexual appeal while keeping theaters safe for all ages. So, Annalie, did you have any thoughts about Harry Potter's emasculization of America?
I don't know. I thought that the article was really interesting. It definitely did make me kind of take a second and realize that the movies that they were talking about is like the big blockbuster movies, Harry Potter, the franchises, rather, the Harry Potter, Twilight, and Transformer movies. I thought it was clever to bring out the fact that there is a trend within the three of them that the male protagonists are very clearly not interested in sex. I mean, sometimes more... it's more of a plot point than in others. I feel like that's a big part of the Twilight storyline. But it's kind of, I think it's interesting that they're talking about how these male characters are, you know, putting their urges aside to, you know, save the world in some way or, like, save their female co-star. But I do feel like I'm maybe suffering from really poor memory, because I'm having a hard time of thinking about, like, the pre-existing, like, really sexual big blockbusters of, like, the 90s or the 80s.
Well, I'm having a hard time thinking of a franchise besides maybe American Pie.
Oh, that's true.
That's true.
Which I do think, you know, would constitute a franchise because there were several, mm-hmm. and it was definitely much more sexual.
Yeah.
I mean, that was basically the whole point of the movie.
Yeah.
Or movies with sex, but... Beyond that, I agree that I'm having a hard time thinking of another franchise, like, series of blockbuster teen movies, which is what all three of the ones that they're referencing are.
Mm-hmm. I mean, outside of, like, and this is kind of going to be what we're talking about in a little bit later, but, like, maybe horror franchises, like the Scream franchises and, or Scream franchise and the I Know What You Did Last Summer franchise, which does have sex to some degree, so...
There's definitely sex in that.
But yeah, I mean, anyway, I thought that the point is definitely interesting, but, yeah, again, I'm having a hard time. I wish they provided more examples, because, like, I want to buy into the argument, but it's... I feel like they're also maybe oversimplifying mm-hmm. what movies were like in the 80s and 90s, kind of like an opposite of what people do with the 50s, where they're like, the 50s were so clean right. and wholesome, but it's like... The 80s and 90s were so sexy.
Right, and now we're being restrained.
Well, that's what I was thinking, that it really seems to me like it's a timeless trope, and maybe the bigger difference now is that these huge franchises are being marketed toward teens. I mean, I don't know how much, like, teens were being sort of targeted before. I mean, I don't really know the details behind all that stuff, but I thinking to any sort of superhero movie or anything with those heroic elements.
Or, like, Star Wars movies.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. There's always that. I mean... There's never a big emphasis on getting laid or anything like that. Even in the Batman movies or anything like that, I mean, there's definitely kind of a side plot, but it's not...
It's certainly not showcased or anything.
Yeah.
Right. I agree, actually, with that argument. I mean, when I think about, for instance, the Star Wars franchise, which did get a revitalization in the late 90s, mm-hmm. I don't remember sex really being that big of a part of it. There was kind of a romance element. But, mm-hmm. yeah, I do think... You know, because they kind of try to make the tie-in in the article, or, you know, the author does, which I thought was at least interesting to think about, which is that, is this a product of abstinence education? Is this a product mm-hmm. of the kind of political climate of the early and mid-2000s, which was perhaps, like, putting more of a focus on chastity and allowing for less sex talk than, say, the Clinton administration, mm-hmm. which saw the American Pie movies?
I don't know. I really feel like it's more genre-specific, and it just has to do with the fact that these movies all are fantasy or, you know, whatever. I think... Because there still are tons and tons of teen, like, super hypersexual teen movies out there.
Though, I mean, I do think there is something to be said about the fact that these three movies are, like, so money-generating. Like, if you think about all of, especially with Harry Potter and Twilight, like, all of the merchandise and... just what a money-making machine those movies are. And maybe that's why we are having a hard time finding something to compare it to, because there's not really anything that has been as popular. And it's like, what is the danger or possible dangers of, like, these movies that are kind of fitting in possibly with, like, an abstinence-only education, like, agenda?
Right.
So maybe it's not a comparing to previous years, but maybe it's a new phenomenon, and that's worth talking about.
Right, and I do think that it's interesting, especially Twilight, but in the most recent Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, which I know, Annal, you saw it, I saw it also, it's a little bit different in that I do feel like there's actually more of a focus on the chastity than mm-hmm. there is in, say, you know, Lord of the Rings or Pirates of the Caribbean, which are two other franchises that were big money makers that had a big kind of merch tie-in. Those movies just, like, left sex pretty much totally out of it. But with Harry Potter and especially Twilight, which we've talked about before, I actually think that the kind of purity aspect gets highlighted a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Romance is very much in the air in Hogwarts, and that leads to inner turmoil.
What you see before you is a curious little potion.
The most powerful love potion in the world.
I'm in love with her.
All right, fine, you're in love with her. Have you ever actually met her?
No. Can you introduce me?
Excuse me, I have to go and vomit. Hermione's beginning to come to terms with the fact that she might possibly have feelings for Ron.
Pregnant. Girls, they're gonna kill me, Harry.
Well, and I think that something that I just thought of, the fact that these movies depend on, you know, sequel after sequel, I guess that doesn't make sense, but the fact that the idea is that they want people to keep coming back, I mean, sexual tension maybe draws more mm-hmm. people to movie theaters, because then there's something that, you know, to come back for. It's not sort of completely resolved like other movies.
Right. I mean, if Bella mm-hmm. and Everett had sex in the movie, I think people maybe wouldn't be as compelled to keep
yeah.
watching, because there's definitely the promise that they are going to do it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think maybe, and something they bring up in the Harry Potter example in this article that I did think was relevant was that we've kind of grown up with these characters and seen them since they were 10 years old for people who have followed the franchise. And so it's almost like seeing a little brother or sister have sex. I mean,
That's true. I actually
am not looking for sex in the Harry Potter
yeah.
movies. And, you know, he's kind of saying, like, might as well call it Harry Potter and the Half-Assed Libido, you know, instead of Half-Blood Prince. Like, where's the manliness? Where's the masculinity? Which I also think it's problematic to equate, like, aggressive male sex come-ons with masculinity, but
yeah.
whatever. I mean, that's kind of where the article's coming from. But
yeah.
it's... I actually don't want to see Harry Potter stick it to Ginny Weasley.
Well,
yeah.
I remember when he was nude in that... Was it, like, a stage
play or
something?
Oh, yeah, Equus.
Equus.
Yeah, people were freaking out because little Harry Potter was, you know...
Right.
Acting like a man.
Well, and it's also weird because especially, like, in terms of actual, like, physical displays of... affection, like the one with Cho Chang in it, which I think was Goblet of Fire.
Goblet of Fire.
Like, he kissed her like way more than he kissed Ginny in this, and so it's like, it's weird also because I think Ginny, especially for those of you who have like read the seventh book, Ginny's like his true love, and so I think it's a different kind of idea about like sex and love that's being promoted in both this and Twilight. It's like sex and love, but with the one that you're meant to be with.
Right, not just, like, sex for sex's sake, the way, you know, they kind of, they cite Teen Witch and Teen Wolf and these 80s kind of, we were talking about Risky Business and these 80s movies that were hyper-sexual and had no, really no focus on, like, the true love that you're meant to be with. I mean, I guess in Risky Business, they end up together, but...
Yeah, but again, I wonder if those are true analogs to these franchises, because I feel like, I don't know if they're... The popularity is really equatable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe it is, but...
And it's also not a series franchise, which
yeah.
I do think is different.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of seems like part of it, in terms of the lack of whatever overt sexuality and these franchises, I think it might kind of be incidental, or it might be something like the more kind of broader-reaching and vanilla something is, the more money you can make, do you know what I mean? So if you make it safer, then you'll attract more people and you just make more money. And so I don't think that it's making money necessarily, like, it hinges only on the fact that they have these sort of, like, chaste characters. But
mm-hmm.
I think that those kind of movies maybe are the kind of movies that just a broader, you know, audience can buy tickets to.
Well,
yeah,
I also think there is something to be said about, you know, I think... to have a successful heartthrob or like teen idol, I do think them, that idol being approachable and safe are important factors, at least today, it seems like. I mean, if not to take it too far off topic, but something I've been talking about with my friends is this phenomenon on reality talent shows, like So You Think You Can Dance and American Idol, and how like this dweeby white guy will just get so far, who's not even like the like hunkiest guy on there, but is just this weird like very approachable and safe and like the kind of guy you could bring home to mom or something. And so I think that there is something to be said about Harry kind of staying likable to female viewers.
And especially because I do think the target audience, I mean, they're calling it a teen movie, and I think that like, yes, that's true, but I would you know, wager that a big portion of the audience is actually younger than
a that's
teen.
What I was thinking, or even older. I mean, I know I've heard a lot of, you know, adult women who are totally crazy about not Transformers but Twilight and Harry Potter. I mean, I would think that the audience is at least like almost equally adults.
Yeah, but I do think, I mean, what I kind of took issue with in this article, I mean, it's coming from like a snarky kind of smarmy Esquire tone, but is this idea that like, hey, man up, dudes, like fuck her already.
Yeah,
it's like,
exactly.
I agree with what Gabriella is saying, which is I don't think that's the point of these movies. And so to kind of call for Edward Cullen and Harry Potter and whatever the Shia LaBeouf character's name is, Willy Witsky or something, to like, you know, whip it out.
Yeah.
It's just not something to expect from these movies.
Yeah.
That's something to expect from, which might be a good segue time, more of the horror genre that Annalie mentioned. And there was an article in Entertainment Weekly this week by Christine Spines called Horror Films and the Women Who Love Them. And I'll read a quick sentence. For decades, it seemed that the sole purpose of movies in which masked and or disfigured men hunted down lusty young damsels was to give guys a 90-minute outlet for their own aggression and hormones. Today, however, the genre's biggest constituency of diehard fans is women. And this is an article about how, like, surprise, women go to horror movies, and women have been enjoying horror movies for quite some time, and that there's going to be a kind of onslaught of women-made and women protagonists starring horror films, you know, that we'll see this season and in the coming years. And so, I don't know, Gabriella, did you have any thoughts after reading the article?
Well, my biggest beef is the stats and the way that they talk about this huge constituency. They kind of make it sound like there's this like it's just this overwhelming majority of women. And then they give the stats for, I think, three different horror movies that have been made in the past, I don't know, 8 years or something. The first stat is 60%, the other 65%, and the other one's 51%. And I don't really know, you know, how they got their numbers, but to me that just doesn't seem like they're necessarily pinpointing any kind of phenomenon where women are actually flocking to these movies. It seems more likely that, as I think somebody was quoted in the article as saying, women just have more sort of ticket buying clout, and so things like that I think are a lot more relevant. So that, I mean, that's just sort of a minor point, but I think it's important to probably highlight that this isn't quite the crazy trend that the article is making it out to be.
Well, and I also think you brought this up earlier when we weren't recording, but just kind of the idea of being like, oh my god, isn't it surprising that women like horror movies, is kind of just frustrating in general, because it's like, oh, what a shocker.
Exactly.
Women
right.
like something more than the ugly truth. Who knew?
Right. I think one of the quotes is, women have a stomach for this, and it's surprising to people.
Yeah, though women in horror movies has been something that I've been interested in for a while, and because I think that, I don't know, there's something, I really want to see the day when, like, feminism is appropriating horror movies as a genre, because I do think that the idea of turning, either real-life fears or, like, fears that we're told, like, women are told to have, turning those things into an experience that, like, all audiences also experience, and thus make, like, women issues universal to audiences, is something that I thought would be a really interesting process. And I think that the article kind of touched on somewhat about that, talking about how, like, maybe women are drawn to it because they're more emotional, and that horror movies are such, like, a visceral experience that maybe it strikes a chord with other, like, emotional trauma that women either have to deal with or are familiar with. Though I am frustrated that they call women emotional creatures.
Right, and they're like, oh, it's, you know, something that I did not love about this article. You know, and again, I mean, it's similar to all the articles we've talked about today. I think that there's, like, a nugget that I really like,
yeah.
but then it's just kind of coded in shit that I don't like.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just this idea that, like, number one, yeah, women are so emotional that they're drawn to these movies. You know, number two, this idea that, oh, maybe a reason why women are going to these movies is because they want to cuddle with their boyfriends yeah. in the movie. And then also, you know, which that they do say that in the article, and it's just kind of insulting. And then also number three, that like, because there are women in the movies, that somehow if we see them doing something, you know, that it's empowering. And
yeah.
Andy actually, our editor here, I was talking to her about this article, and she had the really good example of, you know, she's like, I can't remember who said it, but I heard this quote that calling horror movies empowering to women is like calling a cockfight empowering to the rooster
mm-hmm.
because it shows a rooster being strong and powerful at the end of the fight.
Yeah.
But the fact that all these people are standing around objectifying, you know,
and victimizing.
Totally victimizing.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, this idea, oh, it's an outlet for men's, you know, lust and hormones to see women get murdered. I mean, I have totally seen many horror movies in my day, and I agree with Annalie too, that I am excited about the prospect of feminist horror movies, and I loved the movie Teeth, which
yeah.
I thought was actually a pretty good example of what feminism combined with horror movies can be. But I also think that kind of rewriting the history of the genre to be like, oh, it's empowering to women because it shows women, you know, fighting danger, or that it's like, I think there's a quote in there that the guys get the eye candy they want, and the girls get the sense of, I can face my demon.
Yeah.
And I just don't like that idea. I think it's kind of sugarcoating.
Patronizing.
Yeah, it's totally patronizing, and it's just kind of covering up something they do think is problematic about horror films. Traditionally, not every
yeah.
horror film, but
yeah.
the genre, which is that they do victimize women. And the fact that, like, I mean, they bring it up in the article, and I'm sure we're all aware of the idea that anytime somebody, a woman, becomes sexual in a movie, she's gonna get killed.
Yeah, which was one thing that I thought was somewhat promising about this. I know that we were kind of a little dismissive about Diablo Cody a second ago when we were talking about Juno, but she does bring up her upcoming movie, Jennifer's Body, and how, as a filmmaker, she personally wants to kind of reverse the idea that when a woman has sex in a horror movie, she's gonna die, and that she wants to put a stop to that, is what she says in the article. So.
Yeah. Although I'm actually going to disagree a little bit with being psyched about that, because I have seen the trailer for Jennifer's Body. I wrote about it for the Bitch website. And I don't think that by turning the tables and making the sexual woman character a demon that
mm-hmm.
murders her sex partners, I actually don't think that that's, like, any less condemning of female sexuality. I feel like it's actually literally demonizing it.
I guess, yeah, that's a good point. I haven't seen the trailer, so I was duped.
Several high school students have been brutally murdered. Police are advising all residents to stay in their homes.
Jennifer's evil.
I know.
No, I mean, she's actually evil, not high school evil.
No way.
I need you hopeless.
Please share your bed when we have slumber parties.
Am I too big?
You're killing people.
No, I'm killing boys.
Are you scared?
I thought you only murdered boys.
I go both ways.
I don't necessarily think that that's, like, a more positive
yeah.
portrayal of a woman with sexual agency.
Yeah. And I don't think it's very promising for this genre to be considered, I don't know, a place of female empowerment when you consider, I mean, horror movies don't spend a lot of time developing characters. I mean, it's a lot of, like, screaming and running, and it's really shallow, and so that as kind of the place where women are showcased as being strong and stuff sort of, I don't know, it leaves me kind of cold. But I was also thinking, it seems like there are a lot of other movies where women do a lot of fighting and defending. I mean, Kill Bill and stuff like that. It just seems like the difference is in a movie like, I don't know, Jennifer's Body or a horror movie, there's like a ton more vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just kind of the way that it's staged is different. And I don't know if that makes a difference in the way, like, whether it's more feminist or less feminist, if it's staged in that way.
Right. But I do think that, you know, I'm also hopeful and optimistic. I think the genre has a lot of potential, and I'm glad that women are maybe being considered more. And I also think that as feminists, like, we still shouldn't feel guilty for liking horror movies. You know, we were talking about it earlier, and there is that kind of, like, visceral reaction. People like to get a thrill, and of course we can look at it through a critical lens and say this is problematic for these reasons, but that doesn't mean that, like, the fact that women are going to horror films is a problem.
Yeah.
You know, I actually think, you know, there's things that are problematic about the genre and about this article, but the fact that women are going to these movies, I actually think it's a positive thing, because it does maybe put female audiences, you know, in the space that they deserve to be in, which is that, you know, we're a movie-going audience that has disposable income that likes the same kind of movies that men like a lot of times, you know, and that doesn't make us like, oh, women, what, they're freaks, you know. It's just like, we like to get scared, we like, you know, raunchy movies, we like whatever, abstinent vampires, you know, we like movies,
yeah,
and that's,
I mean,
fine.
Despite my problems with the way that the author went about kind of supporting her argument, I think it's a really interesting question. I mean, if the stats do reveal something about women, you know, really preferring these movies over men, then I think that the question of why they do is really interesting,
yeah,
and people do need to think about it. But I just think that, I don't know, women liking to cuddle is probably the easy solution or
yeah,
answer to that question.
We like snuggling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just too easy.
All right, well, speaking of things women like, it's time for a bitch faves for this episode. Annalie, do you have a fave that you're
really feeling?
That you're feeling?
Yeah, my fave is just a person in general and the body of work that comes along with that person. I'm way into Michael Showalter right now. He has a really good show out with Michael Ian Black called Michael and Michael Have Issues on Comedy Central. And I was just looking at his blog and reading some of his older blog posts, and he did one about Project Runway that I was really into, and he does a bunch of portraits of him and his cat and of just funny faced people and lots of pictures of his cats. He has a cat named Tim and a cat named Louise. And in general, I just think he's a really great comedian, and also someone who is kind of, I feel like, has done projects with, like, funny women in the past. And yeah, I don't know. Michael Showalter, if you're listening to this, give me a call.
All right, let's hope he is. Gabriella?
Let's see. I think I blogged about this project that I recently found out about, even though it was founded in 2006, so it's kind of old, but it's called the Yellow Bird Project. And I just think it's a cool idea. It's a Montreal-based nonprofit, and they seek what they call the coolest of cool musicians. And so it's a bunch of indie rock bands who they partner with, and they design these, you know, artsy T-shirts that you can buy that benefit the charities of the artist's choice. And yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem, you know, irritatingly promotional or anything like that. Most of the shirts are just kind of cute or pretty or trendy or whatever, but they don't have the band names on them necessarily. And then there are a few, I think Bon Iver and some other band each are donating to women's shelters. So yeah, just a little plug for that.
Cool. Well, my fave this week is a blog called Big Feminist Butt with one T. And it's a new blog, and it's based on, or, you know, it's promoting an anthology of feminist graphic novels that actually, I found out, some people from the Bitch Office are potentially going to be contributing to the project, which makes it even more exciting. Andy and Sherston are both really good graphic novelists. But it's really fun, especially for a graphic novel novice like me, to get an idea of, you know, what are some really fun, like, feminist-friendly comics and graphic novels. And they have really fun interviews with artists and, you know, writers that are just kind of talking about their feminist politics, and then just, like, addressing some really funny issues dealing with, you know, feminism in the graphic novel format. It's a really fun blog, and I'll put links to Michael Showalter's blog and the Yellowbird Project and the Big Feminist Butt blog in the, in the body of the blog post for this podcast. So look for those, and we'll put some video clips in there also. So thank you for listening to another episode of Bitch Propaganda, and keep checking bitchmagazine.org for more info on all of the latest feminism and pop culture related topics, and stay tuned for next time. Thank you for tuning in to Bitch Propaganda. This podcast contained audio clips from the official trailers for Spring Breakdown, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, and Jennifer's Body. For more info on this and other Bitch Media podcasts, check out bitchmagazine.org/audio.
Thought you only murdered boys.
I go both ways.